A Pod Forte Podcast.
The next CMO podcast explores topics that are on the minds of forward-thinking marketing executives, from leadership and strategy to emerging technologies. And we bring these topics to life by interviewing leading experts in their fields. The Next CMO is sponsored by Planful for Marketing, a leading marketing performance management solution that automates marketing planning, financial management, and ROI optimization. And hosted by me, Peter Mahoney, an experienced CMO, CEO, board member, and executive advisor. In this episode of the Next CMO podcast, I'm excited to welcome back Ana Villegas. Ana joined us about 6 months ago when she was the CMO of National Instruments. She since joined Affinipay, which is a fintech company selling to lawyers. We talk a lot about the transition that she made between those two wildly different audiences and what's the same and what's different, how things are going in general. And she shares some great advice for current and aspiring CMOs. I'm sure you will enjoy the show. Hello, Ana, and welcome back to the Next CMO podcast. Super excited to have you back again. And for those of you who may not have met you before, it would be great if you could spend a second just telling us who you are and tell us a little bit about Affinipay.
Happy to. So hi, everyone, and thank you for inviting me to join this amazing podcast. Ana Villegas, I'm the Chief Marketing Officer for Affinipay. And I joined the company in November. So it's going to be almost 6 months that I joined the company. Affinipay is a company that supports lawyers, accountants, and other practitioners on the area of supporting them with fintech solutions, primarily payments, and also software to manage their practice.
Got it. Makes a ton of sense and very different from where you were before. And you will have heard about this in the intro that I record later, but you would have heard in the preamble to this. But Ana was before this the CMO at National Instruments, and very different target audience, very different business overall. So I want to ask you a couple of questions about that. But I'll start by, I teased you with this stat before we started the recording that I said I was going to bring up. It's interesting. One of the things that I often bring up from our conversation was the fact that you said that at National Instruments, you went from, I think, 40-something campaigns to 6 campaigns. And I loved that, because what you did is you brought, I think, really strong coherence to an overall marketing plan. And it's something that CMOs I see struggle with a lot. They have a lot of stuff, and you were able to sort of organize the chaos and a lot of activity into a really tight set of campaign strategies. But very different business. So let's talk about this. Tell me about the differences between marketing semiconductors to engineers to marketing to lawyers and other professional service providers.
So let me talk about also similarities and difference, because I'm new to this industry of marketing to lawyers and marketing to accountants. And as you say, I come from National Instruments, it was all about marketing to engineers. Engineers who are building, right, and testing and validating the product that's going to go in market. So a semiconductor is a piece of a bigger product that can be a phone or can be, you know, a computer that eventually will be put in market. So I think that the main similarity, I'll say, for all my CMO friends or aspiring CMOs, really the fundamentals of marketing, building and having a strong demand gen engine, right? Having a strong brand, simplifying, less is more, understanding your customer, they are all, you know, apply regardless of the industry. And I think that's why you see so many CMOs sometimes change from one to the other, because there is a lot of expertise you can bring regardless of, you know, the type of industry. So that will say similarity from, you know, fundamental and functional marketing and agility. I think that the main difference is when we think about the lawyers, yes, we are in the B2B arena because lawyers, right, have customers, have clients they work with. But talking to lawyers, they are so invested in the clients. So in a way, you have to really reach this B2C, right, business to consumer type of marketing when you are talking to the lawyers. They will go the extra step for their clients. Sometimes they will not bill because the client cannot afford it, or they will take extra hours because they are working on a divorce, or they are working on a litigation around, you know, kids' custody. And those topics are so important that these lawyers do it for that passion and because they care for their clients. And I think in other areas like Dell, where I was first, and National Instruments, it's not that they don't care about the ultimate customer, but they are a little far away from the process. They don't own the full relationship. So that has been for me the big one that it's been, this is, you have to remember always to talk to them of what is in the end, and you're not only doing for them, but doing for the clients.
It's really interesting, Anna, the way that you put that thought together, because most people would think that, hey, spending time in B2C, you probably have a deep appreciation for the end customer. Obviously, at National Instruments, you were a step away as an OEM technology component supplier, where you work, provide stuff to the engineers and who are building systems, who build something that ultimately may go through another step and then ultimately get to a consumer. So you can be a little bit farther away. But you reminded us all how important what the end customer impact is at the end of the day, and talking about how what you do can help influence not only your customer themselves, but sort of their end customers, and putting yourselves in their shoes is incredibly important along the way. And we've talked a little bit here about this transition, and it would be great to understand, to tell me about the change, right? So you went from a very technical, you know, CMO job to, and you were there for a little while, not too long, probably didn't significantly change the average tenure of a CMO, which is somewhere around 2 years or something like that. Tell me what drove the change, and is there a broader message about changing roles, CMO roles, that we should take from your shift from National Instruments to Affinipay?
Yeah, I was overall a little 1 month under the 2 year mark as a CMO for NI. And I was not looking, right? I have come to NI initially just driving demand generation, and they expanded my responsibilities, and eventually, when Carla Pinheiro left, I got the promotion to the CMO. And in those 2 years, there was a lot of transformation of building capabilities, right, and modernizing marketing. That was the core thing, and really shifting the team to really leverage the, you know, digital and be more agile and change the way they think about campaigns and plans and all of that. So by the time this call came, even though I was not looking for anything, I also knew that the transformation was starting to slow down, right? That really that the pieces that needed to build, the more macro pieces, I have already built them. And it was more around how do you optimize and keep going, which is not bad, but it was changing what my role and the scope. So I took the call, and the first thing that for me was really caught my attention, because my first call was with the CEO of Affinipay, Drew Armstrong. It was a female leader. And as I started learning more about the company, it was also the founder was a woman. And it, for me, it was like, wow, it's interesting. We talk about, you know, inclusivity. We talk about how we bring women into more positions of power and how very few women have a CEO role, you know, in companies. And this just piqued my attention and say, I want to learn more about this, because I don't know, the times and everything, it just attracted. So as I started talking to Drew and then talking to the team and understanding what the company was about, three things that I think drove my decision. I think the first one, from a marketing transformation, they had just acquired new companies and they were starting the transformation, right? They really were six different brands with six different look and feels and very different demand engines and et cetera. So the first one was, okay, they need a transformation. So I can apply a lot of the things I've done in NI here. So that was number one. There is a transformation that needs leadership, and that's where my strengths are. I think the second one was, I really like the style and the leadership of Drew. The more I not only talk to her, but talk to, you know, the people who are her leadership team, it was interesting to hear her approach, how supportive and really helping also drive the transformation. Sometimes you can have these debates with the CEO where they will be sometimes afraid, right? And you want to go faster and the CEO is trying to go slower, and there's used waste a lot of time just basically politically discussing, right? Can we just make these changes? And she was on the road of, we need to move fast. So that was a priority. And then the third one was the industry. I was like, oh my God, fintech is moving so fast, and software. This is a skill set that, yes, I've done software. We have software at NI. We had software at Dell. But just going into 100% a company that doesn't have hardware, it's all about software and that customer and engagement. That was also super attractive. And I know I said three, but I'm going to add one more. The last one, which was very important, was the people and the culture. So I moved to NI because I really like the culture. So I was not going to jump into a company where the culture and the people will be less. I needed to be to a place that it was always putting people first. And, you know, when I talked with the chief of HR, Erin, and then I talked to the rest of the people, it was very clear that people are always first. And, you know, the leadership spends time listening to people, solving any things or any issues, and always any type of change, always putting the people first. So I think those were the four pieces that make my decision really start leaning into, hey, I want to take this risk. I think that I might have done my job here at NI, and I'll be, you know, and I think I've done a good job. Let me start doing it somewhere else. And it seems like the great place to do it.
Well, that's great. And so much to get into there. I want to dig into a few of these things, but I wanted to start first, Anna, with the industry change that you made. And from a career perspective, I think a lot of people are thinking about this now. And whenever there's some turbulence going on in the economy, tech is challenged right now a little bit, and there's been a lot going on there as an example. And whenever there's that kind of change, there are a lot of people think about, hey, can I change industries? Is that possible to do? And you're a pretty good example of someone who's now successfully gone from Dell to National Instruments, which was actually a fairly significant change, and now a really different change to Affinipay. And tell me about the challenges. What were you worried about around this kind of change in industry? Were you ever concerned that, hey, I may not know how to do this because it's too different?
So I think I had My big concern was more when I moved from Dell to NI, because that was the first time I was doing this type of change. Okay, from going after IT decision makers to going after hardcore engineers. But I think coming to this one, even though I knew I had to have a big ramp because I had to learn about the customer and the audience, and I'm not a lawyer, at the same time, I feel confident that I could do it. And and I will say this to anyone who is considering this type of move. You're an expert in the things you do. If you change your field, you need to learn, but the expertise doesn't go away. So the fact that, you know, you need to figure out the Salesforce and working with leads and with sales, all these things are things that happened in, you know, in B2B. Maybe if you move from B2C to B2B, it's a little more difficult. But if you've been doing B2B and now I move into a B2B, almost B2C, I think a lot of the things apply.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's interesting. You mentioned a little bit earlier the idea of sort of the fundamentals and getting down to the basics. And the reality is that good marketing practice is good marketing practice. And I see it over and over. As you know, I've worked with hundreds and hundreds of marketing leaders, and not only through this podcast, but from my company and that I sold recently. And it's really interesting to see. You can see that the people who are successful really fundamentally think about the same kind of principles about who's my customer, what's my strategy, what is the plan? You know, some pretty basic things like that. And if you can get your arms around those things, then I think you have great potential to be successful. And now, the other thing that you mentioned on, I wanted to go back to and get a little bit more perspective from you around, is this idea of working for a female CEO. So what have you found different in that change? And if you think about the things that are different from this perspective, do you think it's because female CEOs are different, or is it because this CEO is different?
I think that, and this is something I'm realizing right now, I think through my career, I'm used to reporting to, you know, male. And as I grew and moved up, I had male bosses. So I really, if you have asked me before, I could have said, okay, I like the concept of reporting to a woman CEO, but I really don't know what the difference is. I think the difference is that in anything they do, and Drew is that way, but I'm sure other CEOs are that way. They have the inclusivity and the thinking how to bring, you know, other women and how to, and realizing sometimes the elephant of the room. Like guys, nothing against them, right? Everybody's great, but they've never been on the shoes of a woman. So sometimes they forget small things. They will just go and say, you know, said, oh, let's go to this sports bar. Well, as a woman, I don't watch sports. So can you do something that is more, I feel, right, that I'm going to have a good time? Or things, little things like that. I just feel like she's always thinking, what's something that not only my male leaders, but my female leaders, you know, integrate on. And again, you work with your male partners. They start with the sports talk and the jokes, and I sometimes feel like I don't belong. And she brings and says, hey guys, stop talking about this. Let's, you know, let's be more, let's talk about this other topic. So it's little things that I didn't realize that happened so many times until I start working with her.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm sure it's some of those things that may seem at the time to be little, but also have a fairly significant impact. And I know I've seen a fair amount of research that speaks to the fact that when there is female leadership in place, companies tend to be more successful. They break the law less. I mean, there are lots of things that are important about it. And I think the idea of really driving for more senior female leadership and governance in general is really important. In fact, in my last company, one of my board members and our first institutional investor was a woman, and she had to really create this interesting mixture of dealing with a bunch of very hard-driving venture capitalist type, board member type people. And at the same time, needed to make sure that she brought in sort of that sensibility and brought in a different perspective. So it's amazing to see along the way. It reminds me that I know a little bit about your personal story that is pretty amazing. But if people hadn't heard the last episode, and I encourage them to go listen, and I'll put a link to the last one in the notes of the first one. But just give us a kind of a quick view of how you got to where you are and where you started, because that to me is really amazing, Anna, sort of where you started in the world and how you got to where you are.
So I'm from Peru, Latin America, and I grew up in a very traditional society where really the expectations for me from my parents was that I needed to, you know, marry somebody, become a wife, raise my kids, and be an amazing housewife. And I don't have anything against housewives. I think that, you know, people do different things. But in my case, there was not a selection. It was just, this is what you're going to do. And so I had a father who was, I never saw him because he was working all the time. He was an entrepreneur, always trying to build business. And a mom who was always at home because, you know, that was her role. And I started, and I went to an all-girls school. So from, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, I started asking why I cannot be like my dad. He goes, he has all these meetings, he travels, right? And I don't want to stay home all the time. So I started just asking those questions and eventually decided to, because I was good at school and I got a good advice from one of my mentors, which was an aunt, decide to pursue engineering career. And my dad is an engineer. So when I told him I want to be an engineer, he was like, why? You should study to be a teacher, you know, something like, or some art classes. And I was like, no, I want to be an engineer. So they accepted, but reluctantly. They thought, okay, we're going to pay for this. She's going to get bored and that'll be it, right? And this thing has passed. So I went to study engineer, and that was my first, you know, reality check with being in a room full of, you know, male students. And to me, there were mostly no women in an engineering class. I think we graduated 6 women out of 600 students in engineering. So that was, you know, very few female. So I think that gave me really an initial drive of, I can do this, but it's not going to be easy. So I felt, especially in Peru, that I had to fight the system. And I eventually had a career for 8 years in Peru, successful, but I eventually left because I realized it's, first of all, it was very difficult to keep a boyfriend because they will all eventually get mad at me because I was too opinionated. I will speak, you know, in front of their bosses, and I was supposed to stay quiet and, you know, I will have thoughts about work. So I just got tired and I was like, this is, I cannot do it here. I need to leave. My parents didn't want me to leave, of course. They were like, why would you even leave? You are here, you work. So I ended up, you know, applying to Kellogg, being accepted, and then taking a big $100,000 loan, which I didn't have any money. So that's, you know, that I'm glad I was able to get the loan. And with that, I just came here with my 2 suitcases and just my drive of, I'm going to make it happen in the US. I'm going to continue my career in a place that I think can be more inclusive.
Well, it sounds like there was a pretty good return on investment at that $100,000 investment in Kellogg. First of all, it's a great school. And certainly, I'm sure you would have been successful without it, but you've had an amazing career so far. And I know there's a lot more to come. I'd love to spend a little bit more time understanding about, we talked about this transition. We talked a little bit about where you were. Let's talk a little bit about where you are. It'll be great to understand a little bit more about, you know, what's your marketing strategy at InfiniPay? You know, who's the target audience? We've heard a little bit about its lawyers. Is it big firms? Is it small firms? And then what's your overall strategy that you use to drive growth for InfiniPay?
So I think that the first thing I did, and I recommend to any new CMO coming into a role, it's I did an assessment of where is my team spending their time and what is really the strategy, right? What are we doing? Yes, we're going primarily after lawyers, but what does that mean? I think that from an audience perspective, we actually work with small and medium business lawyers, but we also work with the big enterprise lawyers. So it's across, right? And we also work in all the industries. So family lawyers, immigration lawyers, you know, and other areas with personal injury. We work with all different type of lawyers. So it was a matrix, but my first aha was that we really didn't have a strategy around each of these different audiences. We basically had more a one-size-fits-all. So we were doing campaign, an email campaign, and, you know, online advertising campaign, a search campaign, and you name it. When you start adding all the things that we were doing, it was hundreds, right? Because everything was a campaign. But in the end, it was all lawyers. It was a one size fits all. So my main strategy, just making it very basic, is building a message and a, you know, a customer journey that has different, you know, variables and looks at different audiences. So we can engage them in a different way. We can manage the funnel in a different way. I think the second part of that is looking at the end-to-end customer journey. You know, the team have been working aligned by function, so you can have your email strategy or your social media strategy or your PR strategy. And turning this, you know, the other way around and saying, okay, let's talk about this audience and what is everything we are doing across the customer journey to drive that audience. So I think those are the main things that the strategy around audiences and then customer journeys that are really helping me pivot the way we align, the way we build the plan, and the way we can drive outcomes for the business. And it also makes it easier for everybody because managing hundreds of campaigns, as you know, I experienced it in the night, is not easy. And everybody's just working, you know, nonstop to put everything out. So one of the main pivots to be able to make this change is that the teams were used to work with different tools where people can request an email, people can request a social media post, etc. And my main ask was, why? Like, we need a plan and we need to see what's best for the customer. And then that gets executed versus being a take order organization. Because in a take order organization, you're measured based on how many things you can deliver, but you don't know if you're going in the right direction and it's the right use of resources.
Well, it's amazing. And it's funny how you came at two very different situations, very different companies, obviously. And National Instruments had a different set of problems where they were doing a lot of stuff and it wasn't especially coherent. And you brought coherence to the plan by reducing the number of campaigns. And what you did here in Affinipay is similar. But the thing that's different is that you really organized around these key audiences to align the campaign strategy so that it would be relevant as well as coherent, so relevant to the specific audiences. Now, tell me, in that model, I'd love to hear how you've organized the team to achieve that alignment. Did it require a change? And in how now is, so who's in charge of these sort of segmented campaigns and where do they plug into the organization?
So yes, I have made some changes to the organization. Also, when I came, I joined in November, the team hasn't had a CMO since February. So, and leader has left. So it was a mismatch, you know, not everybody had leaders. So I had 17 people reporting to me and I knew I needed some leaders, right, to manage part of this business. I organized the team into basically four areas, very similar to what I had at the night. The first one is all around the brand. That also includes PR, includes, you know, the thought leadership, social media, communications. It's all part of the brand. And actually, a function that didn't officially exist that I have created is the campaign manager. So, which for me, everybody in any company needs a campaign manager. So we have now created that function of campaign manager. We just hired a senior campaign manager 2 weeks ago. But all that sits under Rachel. She leads all that piece of the brand campaign management of leadership. The second big area is, I'm calling it the 360 demand gen. So when I look at the team, the team who was doing demand gen was specifically doing paid media. And demand gen is not only paid media. Demand gen is events. Demand gen is working with a channel. Demand gen is even non-organic. Right? All of that is how you're going to drive your demand generation. It's not only paid media. So The leader that I brought, Sheila, she owns 360 Demand Gen, and she has the traditional Demand Gen plus events plus partners. That's the second function. The third function is operations. And the first thing I asked from the operations team was, I need to know the budget. I need to know where we're spending the money, how. And in the past, the budget got assigned by owners, but nobody was looking at the budget holistically. So if somebody owned $5,000, at the end of the year, they will say what they did with their $5,000 versus, wait a second, we need to be able to, you know, move change around and be agile. Nobody should be owning a piece of the budget. We should be looking at it holistically. So the ops team has budget, had lead gen processes, right? All the lead part, MarTech, analytics. And then I have the content and the creative teams who are building all the content and the creative. So those are the four macro functions. And again, the role I created was the campaign manager, which I felt in order to have, you know, a more streamlined and targeted plan, we needed campaign owners to own the end-to-end.
And do your campaign owners, do they operate sort of like a product manager where they are sort of accountable for the result of the campaign and have to reach across different elements of the organization to get things done? So maybe they have to coordinate efforts through the content and creative team or other elements of the brand team. And so is that the approach that you use, Anna?
Yes, they operate like a program manager. By the way, I forgot, I have product marketing also sits under the brand. The product marketing team is looking at the specific products and how we convert all the technical stuff into things that the customer can use, right? But the campaign manager will be the end-to-end. It's the glue that brings everything together and ultimately responsible for the success of the campaign. But there is not a one-to-one for every product there is a campaign, right? Because that's when you start looking at audiences. And one product can have different campaigns depending on your audiences. That's why it's not one-to-one, but yet you have to align it in a way that makes sense for ultimately the customer.
So you mentioned that the structure is at least logically very similar to what you had at National Instruments. And obviously National Instruments was a very large company, over $1 billion, if I remember correctly, and between 1 and 2 billion, I think. And Affinipay, I think, is a private company, but probably smaller, right? So has that required you to think differently about how you manage the team like this, because you likely have less resources?
Yeah, you have to definitely be more nimble and see where you can use external expertise versus building the capabilities internally, right? So it's much more of fluidity of, okay, I need this type of person who can be more a consultant, who can help the team in A, B, and C. I need this other person who can come for 2 months, and have that more as a variable that you leverage depending on what the need is versus just having everybody in your team. And, you know, it doesn't make sense.
And now you mentioned that thought leadership is an element of the brand team. Is that central to your marketing strategy, or is it one piece of an overall more broader marketing strategy?
Well, we are moving it into being part of the customer journey. I think that before, it was a separate effort. It was just thought leadership. We were doing trainings and, you know, posting content, very good content. We have 2 very senior lawyers in my team who are actually the ones who build and share and are influencers on thought leadership. But now we're saying, wait a second, let's see how that connects with the email we're going to send afterwards and the webinar. And just an example, you know, last year we were doing these thought leadership trainings called CLEs, and because they were done separate, we were not really, you know, seeing, can any of these customers become a lead or ultimately we can sell them something. This year, because we have started looking at it holistically, we went from, you know, I think one of our CLEs, we got over 300 prospects. It's huge. I think last year we got 6 in total. And here we got 301 because we connected the content, how we talk about something that we are talking in marketing, right? And we can follow the conversation in social media, and that make a big difference. So the team are also starting to see that the more we can connect the touches, the easier it is to get the customer attention, right? And interest and, you know, an engagement.
Well, it's amazing that, in fact, I'm just writing something about building thought leadership programs. So, and it piqued my interest as I went into it. And the idea of having some real deep domain expertise is incredibly important. And in fact, at my last CMO gig before I did my CEO gig last was at a company that had healthcare as a primary target market. So we had, I think, half a dozen doctors on staff, very much for this purpose, just like the lawyers you have at AffiniPay. They were very focused on creating thought leadership and really informing everything from the product to the message to the marketing, and worked heavily with customers. And it was an incredibly valuable thing to do. And you couldn't really implement a thought leadership strategy in a specific domain like that, or any domain, unless you have someone who really, truly gets it and is a thought leader. And I think a lot of people try to make that shortcut. So not surprisingly, you gamed it out correctly, which is great. Well, believe it or not, we're actually at the end of our time already, Anna. And as you know, one of the things I like to ask everyone is what advice you would offer to current or aspiring CMOs.
I think that keep learning. So sessions like this, the next CMO, important, very important. Things are moving so fast. I feel like CMOs are really at the heart of the transformations, the way, you know, people engage with content, the way digital is accelerating, and all the AI and everything that's going on. So always keep learning and, you know, keep your network of CMOs. Make sure that reach out and ask for questions. We don't have all the answers. So let's be a good community and let's just share. There is so much knowledge which you start asking people accumulated through the years.
As usual, Anna, fantastic advice and great conversation. I really appreciate it. Thank you again for being on the show again today. And thank you all for listening to the podcast. Make sure you follow the next CMO and now Planful, because we were acquired. It's now Planful, not Plana, on Twitter and LinkedIn. And if you have any ideas for topics or guests, you can email us at thenextcmo@planful.com. And I hope you have a great day. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.